Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Omfer podcast, a weekly discussion on key trends in investment and economic policy from some of the world's leading commentators. I'm Emma McGarthy, Head of Policy Analysis Sustainability at Omfer, and today we will be discussing how to develop sustainable business models and drive private investment into climate mitigation. I'm joined by Pat Wu, who is Global Co-Head for Sustainable Finance at KPMG, and Vikram Kumar, who is New Business Manager, Infrastructure and Natural Resources in the Asia-Pacific region at the International Finance Corporation. So welcome both, and thank you for joining me today, Pat and Vikram.
Thank you for having us, Emma.
Likewise.
Fantastic. So jumping straight in, I think my first question will be, what are the key elements and frameworks which are required for a sustainable business model? And how does this differentiate from a standard business model? And Pat, I will go to you first.
Right. I think, a sustainable business model, in the capital markets now is really predominantly related to ESG, environment, social and governance aspects. The key area that most people are focusing on right now is very much on climate change. If we could kind of like start there, I think, it is very much a transformational aspect within a business that you do need to start with that governance aspect of getting the top to really realize that this is a business imperative. And as I'm sitting here in the UK at the moment, there's just everywhere. It's just all about, climate and net zero and sustainability and all of that. So from that perspective, I just feel, it is not something nice to have, but it is a must have. How does that kind of like from the top down permeate through the organization? And for, the colleagues in the different departments to be able to take this on board and, add this lens to what they're already doing. But it is very much, organizational transformation that is needed, and it's a mindset transformation.
How can organizations kind of change this mindset? And what would you say kind of is good governance in terms of implementing sustainable and climate strategies?
Well, I think, how we've been helping, we've been doing so many board and C-level training at the moment, but it has to, make it real for them, and it's different for different sectors. But I think that, having it at that board level having a director kind of responsible for this, I think it's critical. And we've also been helping companies set up these sustainability committees at the board level. So similar to an audit committee, but a sustainability committee. Through that, how at the board level, usually led by an in-ed, then kind of like drive through to the executive level and get the C-suite connected with this. One final thing I'd like to say is that what we're seeing a lot more of executive remuneration connected to sustainability performance. That really makes it real.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that does definitely help. Getting some nice remuneration packages of it. Vikram, what are your thoughts on this? Do you have anything to add in terms of frameworks and kind of key elements required for sustainable business models, and also perhaps touching on this, implementing the new structures, kind of changing the mindset, implementing good governance and accountability tools to enable this?
Really gave a great head start, because I think real change starts at the top, right? If you get the top management, the board really pushing management in the right direction, you get real stuff done. You combine that with and there's a jargon that we in the IFC use a lot, which is an environmental and social management system, which is something that we require all our clients to implement, right? Any recipient of IFC financing needs to implement an ESMS, a management system that actually is completely focused on ensuring the operations of that IFC is supporting are compliant with our performance standards, which you know, I would argue are probably the global benchmark in terms of sustainability principles being imbibed into day-to-day operation of businesses across almost every sector there is. And the IFC performance standards, have been imbibed and morphed into the Equator principles, which a lot of the large commercial banks, the HSBCs, the Standard Charters of the world have already adopted, right? These are all Equator banks, and I'm reasonably confident that a lot of other large international banks will absorb this over the next few years, right? And that's where you start real change, right? If you force financial institutions to start really thinking about sustainability in a very serious manner, all financing comes with this sustainable tag attached to it. It will force corporates to think about sustainability, right? It's, you link it to money. Executive compensation is one way of doing it. But if a bank lends money and says, dear corporate, if you want this money, you need to do X, Y, Z to align your operations with these standards of sustainability, which, by the way, have been clearly fleshed out in so-and-so framework. Whether it's the Equator principles or it's the IFC performance standards, there's a lot of standards out there that can be pointed to. To give you a sense, right, $43 trillion is the force of the sustainable banking network. And this network exists today, right? It's something that we spearheaded a few years back. And that force can really make a lot of corporates think seriously about sustainability over the longer term. So, that's one way of, really forcing businesses to think more deeply about sustainability, building in management systems that are able to convert board and stakeholder perspectives and strategy into real action on the ground.
Yeah, that sounds really fantastic. Could you elaborate slightly more on these IFC performance standards and what they involve and how corporates can kind of implement these and embed these into their company structures?
So they're basically, it's actually, this is publicly available information. There are these 8 performance standards we have, and they focus around various aspects of corporate business, whether it's labor, whether it's social displacement of people when you're doing an infrastructure, project, the systems that you have in place, your impact on the environment around you, whether it's air or water or land, right, pollution, the standards that you follow there. Indigenous people, right? Are you impacting indigenous people? Are you impacting water bodies? What's your impact on biodiversity? So there are many such aspects that are covered in these 8 performance standards. And I would encourage actually a lot of people to, really look this up. It's publicly available information. It's very well fleshed out. And it's completely absorbed in the Equator principles that most European banks and US banks have actually already imbibed. And I think once you're able to convince a business, whether it's a financial business or it's a corporate, to agree to comply with these performance standards, that's the battle won effectively, because everything that they do henceforth will need necessarily to be sustainable from that perspective, right? And I think even a thermal power business, a gas business, can be sustainable. Sustainability, only one aspect of sustainability points to climate change, right? That's one aspect. But how you do operations, how you treat your people, how you treat the environment around you, how do you treat the ecosystem, how do you contribute to the people you're impacting is a big part of sustainability also. And that those values are what these performance standards allude to.
Yeah, brilliant. I particularly like the reference to impacts on indigenous communities and things like that, which I think is very important, especially when we're looking at biodiversity and kind of transition plans within that. So another question is, as businesses transition to sustainability, how and kind of are looking to change their portfolios, reallocate capital and generally kind of change their financial flows, how can they remain profitable? And Pat, I'll go to you first.
Well, I've been in this whole sustainability space for close to 15 years now. And throughout those 15 years, everybody has come back and said, well, you know, it's just a cost. It's, you know, it's a cost to the business. But I think that, that narrative is, you know, becoming a bit obsolete now, simply, from, what Vikram has been talking about, whereby if you don't do it, you know, first of all, you're probably going to be out of business. You know, your access to capital will be significantly diminished. So I head up sustainable finance at KPMG. So I actually touch asset management, banking and insurance. And when you hit those three sectors, you're talking about all the types of capital that's needed. And you don't have investors, you don't have loans, you don't have insurance, you're not going to be able to do your business. And so, you know, all three of those sectors are, you know, moving heavily into this area of reviewing the ESG performance of their investee companies or their customers, you know, may it be insurance customers or loan customers. And so I think that, you know, it is important for, you know, corporates to understand that this is something that they will have to bring on board, similar to, you know, many different things that's coming out, you know, in the regulatory or in the business space. So, you know, I think that the cost of not doing it far outweighs the cost of doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. Vikram, anything to add to that?
I think the last statement that Pat said really, you know, resonated with me. For me, actually, you know, inculcating sustainability is actually great business because A, you make money, for sure. It's a huge business opportunity rather than, I would say, argue a cost. But, in addition, it's risk mitigation. And at the end of the day, you know, you're in the business of making money and minimizing risk, and having sustainability as a core aspect of your operations helps you do both, right? Because you end up making more money. There's a huge amount of money to be made in renewable energy. As we've all seen, the big energy developers in the world are all capitalizing on solar energy, building massive projects, you know, earth-shattering records in terms of solar pricing, power pricing coming down to, you know, below 3 cents. There's amazing news for all of us, right? And for generations to come. But beyond that, when we do build large infrastructure projects and we have impacts on people around us, on environments, on ecosystems, how we manage and mitigate those risks have massive ramifications for the long-term performance of those projects, right? If you don't treat the flora and fauna around you, you're impacting the ecosystem in a way that will definitely come back and haunt you in 5 years from now. The people who are dependent on the fish in a downstream river on a hydroelectric project, right? If you're not thinking about how the fish will actually travel upstream and be able to spawn and, you know, rejuvenate their own life cycles, the fishermen will not be able to, you know, survive. And if the fishermen will survive, they will strike and they will create problems for your project. So this is good business. You know, this is not about, you know, saving pennies, right? If you don't do this, you are potentially compromising your long-term survival, to be very honest, right? So this is the stick side, the incentive side of it's great business. I think the other point that I really wanted to bring out is that today, with the large amount of sustainable finance options out there, right? You're looking at social bonds, green bonds, the new mantra is blue bonds, and we've recently developed a framework for blue bonds, which we'll be rolling out globally. And these financings really reward companies for being more sustainable. So if you are more sustainable, then the cost of your capital goes down. There's more institutional capital chasing companies which have higher standards of ESG governance, because, you know, that's what investors are looking for today. And so you can make more money also by reducing your average cost of capital. So there's real opportunity in sustainability. Thanks. Yeah.
And I just want to add, I mean, listed companies, a significant amount of listed companies have ESG ratings. And I think that that's very much in focus at the moment, from investors, as well as banks and others. And, there's been so much study done. And I think that it's just getting even more, prominent now that, higher rated, companies, tend to perform better, from a pricing or performance standpoint. I think, if ESG rating is high, I personally really think that it's just good governance. It just means that the company is being run well and taking into account all of this risk management aspects and looking into those opportunities that are out there. So, if you don't have this at the board and the C-suite level, are you actually fit for purpose in the 2020s? Is my question. That is a question a lot of the asset allocators and investors are asking.
Yeah, I think excellent points. One thing in terms of opportunities that you're touching upon and kind of this idea of kind of a wider set of capital, which is available in sustainable business models, but also looking at kind of infrastructure development, with renewable energy, which I think is a really interesting point. Obviously this is developing, but there is still a high amount of, investment and subsidization going into kind of old school oil and gas companies, as obviously, which is still the kind of primary energy source. How can private investors kind of be leveraged to channel capital into these infrastructures? And what would you say are kind of the key drivers for these investors as they kind of channel this capital, as they look to these investment opportunities? And Vikram, I'll go to you first.
Yep. So, I think the biggest channel is capital markets, right? I think you are seeing a lot of institutional capital, and I mean, the pension funds from Canada, sovereign wealth funds from some of the wealthiest countries in the world, chasing returns, targeting sustainability and targeting emerging markets, where one would argue is the biggest opportunity as far as really making massive strides on key areas like climate change, right? If you look at India and China in particular, right, the biggest greenhouse gas emitters in the world because of their dependence on coal. And now you can say that's a big problem, but I say the transformation and the transition away from coal is a massive opportunity for investors, not just regionally, but globally. And private capital sitting in Canada, sitting in the US, sitting in London is actually searching for opportunities to connect to these developments on the ground. And how do you do that? Is through capital market issuances. There are massive amounts of capital being raised in Singapore today, for example, which is going into India, into renewable energy infrastructure, which is going into Malaysia, which is going into China. And this institutional capital is chasing sustainability. For the biggest aspect for infrastructure, which is potentially yielding higher returns than what developed markets, would potentially give them. But again, more importantly is the whole green angle, right? Is the money going into making real change on the ground as far as climate is concerned? So we've ourselves been involved with multiple such issuances. We financed we were anchor investors in the Continuum Green Bond, which was listed in Singapore earlier this year. We were investors in the ACE Bond, which is a very prominent renewable energy developer in the region. And by taking these kind of anchor positions in these green bond issuances, we are actually making it more comfortable for a lot of potentially risk-averse capital to come into these emerging markets, right? We feel as a development institution, as a multilateral, it is our role to take the first step and show the way. And some of these early steps will really help mobilize much, much larger pools of capital. So this is more on the debt side. Then of course there are massive opportunities on the equity side, and big platforms being set up to develop and grow renewable energy portfolios, to develop solutions like, you know, district cooling, district heating, right? These are technologies where in the West, which are sort of accepted realities, but they do not exist in Asia. So that learning, that experience, the value of actually absorbing these energy efficient ways of managing, basic human needs. The only way to make that happen is to make capital technology expertise move from where it is to where it is really needed today.
Thank you, Vikram. So Pat, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I think, we have to see that this is a shift in capital towards sustainability. I think the go-to report that I've been looking at for the past several years is this Global Sustainable Investment Alliance, GSIA report. The latest report is a 2020 report, which came out, I think, a couple of months ago. And you can see that there's over 40 trillion US dollars in that space, the types of investment that has some type of ESG angle to it, from negative screening all the way to impact. So we have to understand that this whole space of sustainable investment is a spectrum. So there are different strategies. But I think that we've been seeing, significant growth year on year in multiple markets in sustainable investing. And also, I think what we're seeing is that there are so many products coming out on the market that you can kind of like buy ETFs that's related to, say, lithium for batteries, or for the carbon pricing. You can also buy into global carbon pricing and things like that. So the ETF market is very, very vibrant in coming up with these kind of products. But I think that where the biggest growth is this whole area of ESG integrated investment, where the asset managers are incorporating ESG considerations into their investment decisions. And we saw the growth of that of that part of the pie of that 43 trillion increase the most in the past 2 years. I think the asset management industry is under review as to how well they're doing this. Morningstar, they have these ratings of, investment houses and how they're doing, in this area. Another report that came out last year called Point of No Return by Share Action. They have actually highlighted the top 75 asset managers globally and how they have how well they're incorporating ESG considerations. So, with all of these reports, all of these ratings, not only at the corporate level, but at the asset management level, I think that everybody is looking at, well, how well are people doing this, and seeing the opportunity of kind of like getting on the bandwagon as these funds and as a capital move in that direction. I'm based in Hong Kong, although I'm in the UK right now, but I think that, China's, decarbonization, carbon peak by 2030, carbon neutral by 2060. Those are very, very aggressive targets. But at the same time, I think that it's also probably one of the biggest investment opportunities of our lifetime. If we invest into kind of like, decarbonization of China. So I think that, as a private investor or as institutional investors, I think there should be, you really need to look at this space, because we've seen that the market is moving in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also now have things like Climate Action 100+, which kind of shows the influential role that investors and asset managers can actually have in kind of driving climate change, which I think is really fantastic to see. So we touched upon regulation very briefly earlier, and I'd love to kind of go into this a little bit more, but obviously kind of building new sustainable business models obviously involves meeting the developing requirements which are happening in the financial sector space regarding climate change. So such as the task force on climate related financial disclosures and taxonomy regulations, especially in the EU, which are coming from governments. So what are the challenges in incorporating these new frameworks and reporting frameworks into your business models? And yeah, Pat, I'll go to you first, and then Vikram, and I'll then come to you.
Well, I think that Vikram mentioned this earlier in the podcast. There are so many standards out there. And I think that there is where the clarity is needed. You know, regulators all around the world are requesting certain things. And you know, I think that one of the roles that company like ours, like KPMG, you know, can do is, you know, just to talk to regulators, to help them to understand what's happening in different jurisdictions. And the fact that the market is crying out for, you know, a bit more standardization. So, you know, I think, ESG moving really, you know, up the, importance up in importance in the capital markets has only been a few years. And so, you know, it is still quite early days. And so you know, the market is still kind of like figuring a lot of things out. But I think that, you know, if regulators can really kind of, you know, have a standard way or a standardized way of looking at all the different standards out there, that would be great. And what we're seeing is probably, you know, especially in the finance space, is that TCFD, the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosures, is that go-to standard and framework whereby they're getting, you know, banks and asset managers and insurance companies to report. And so, you know, I think that TCFD is something that, well, we're helping a number of clients, incorporate that and, you know, moving from qualitative disclosures to quantitative disclosures and metrics and targets as to how they're actually going to incorporate, you know, these, climate related risks, into their business process. And so, you know, I think that clarity is important. And really important to look at TCFD. And the final point is probably, you know, look at what EU is doing, because EU seems to be kind of like ahead of the game, and a lot of the rest of the world is looking at the EU for a bit of direction in this area.
Absolutely. Vikram, is anything that you'd like to add to that?
I think the challenge is real, right? And I think when you're talking about developed markets, it's, I guess, debatable whether there are any issues, because it is largely coordinated. There might be differences here and there, but if you look at most developed markets, the standards are stringent. You know, they're up there in terms of what is expected from corporates, what's expected from financial institutions in terms of reporting, in terms of, you know, what needs to be done. The real challenge is in the markets that we operate, the emerging markets, right? You go to a Laos or a Bangladesh or a Cambodia or an India, and you really see a big decision for governments, right? Should they tighten up their standards to European EU levels or US levels, which might encourage or discourage investors to invest in that country, because there is a cost associated with, you know, those high standards, right? For everything, whether it's pollution, whether it's X, Y, Z, whether it's compensation to people whose land is being lost. So there is this interesting, you know, debate about what's the, how stringent or how tough do you need to get on standards, and yet not drive capital away. So that debate is something that we are in the middle of a lot of the time, because every investment that we support in emerging markets needs to comply with our performance standards, which are consistent with developed world standards, right? So urging corporates, financial institutions to imbibe standards that are higher than what local regulations require. Now, one can say that's good business, so you should do it, but it is not always an easy road to take, right? For the corporate and for us to push that dialogue with individual private sector clients or financial institutions is much more challenging. But now we're taking that game to the level of governments and to the level of central banks, where if the central banks and the governments are able to modify their standards to be stringent, more stronger, then you can expect this more sustainable capital to keep coming in and open the doors to the pools of institutional ESG linked capital that would normally not have targeted this country in the past. So, you know, you sort of use the carrot and the stick at the same time.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, look, thank you so much, both of you, for joining the podcast today. I think it's a really interesting conversation, and great to kind of hear the positiveness that's coming out and kind of this the development of capital and the opportunities that are there for sustainable business growth and as we transition in financial markets. So thank you ever so much, and thank you for listening. You can subscribe to this and all other OMFIF podcasts on our channel on Spotify and iTunes.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.